Okay, Representative Downey, I think I'm going to have you start going here, even though we do not have a quorum. If you could just talk about your bill, and then if we have questions, we can get going with that, and then I will get your bill officially moved after we call it to order.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we're talking about House File 681. I am actually really excited about this bill. As I have said before, I think it's perhaps one of the few truly transforming type of initiatives since I've been down here. There's a bunch coming, and I don't want to say this is the biggest thing or the newest thing, but it's really, I think, an important concept for us to consider. The bill is proposing that we implement this concept in a pilot mode. So why don't I do a quick description of the proposal and the idea, a very quick walkthrough of the bill, and then we do have a couple of testifiers, hopefully including the person who actually originated this idea as well, who is en route. So the concept, members, is that in contrast to what we currently do typically in state government in terms of appropriations, to create a new pay-for-performance model. And if you think about how we fund things in the traditional appropriation model, we pass a bill and we appropriate funds, and then we encumber and expend those funds. And then after that, on occasion, we'll take a look back and see whether or not the program that we were funding or the organization that we were funding actually produced the intended outcomes or actually accomplished the intent of the legislation and the appropriation. And I think all of us realize that in these tight times, a higher standard and approach where we can really pay for outcomes, for true value, for performance as compared to just our good intentions, good though they are, maybe not translating all the time to true outcomes, that this would give us a mechanism to truly pay for performance. So the idea is, instead of just directly appropriating money, we would create a pay-for-performance pool of funds and only pay organizations upon their accomplishment of the intended outcomes, the defined metrics that we establish with them. And this idea originates from an organization that we actually fund through our workforce development accounts right now, an organization called Twin Cities Rise. They work with people who are in the probationary world or folks who are perhaps just out of incarceration in a workforce development approach. And the state only pays them at the point that one of their clients gets a job, and then again when they've had that job with health care benefits for a year. And so we do have an example right here in state government right now. It's a very small appropriation in the grand scheme of things, extremely small in the grand scheme of things, but we actually have an organization that has been willing to put itself out there and say, we're only going to get our appropriation from the state when we produce some kind of an outcome. Unless and until we produce that, we won't get paid. And so that organization, Twin Cities Rise, and its founder, Steve Rothschild, is sitting next to me, really was the genesis for this bill. And so the mechanics of how we do this in state government is a little different, and this is what we need to explain today and have some discussion on, and hopefully get a chance to put this bill to a point where it could be implemented in a pilot mode. So the mechanism, very briefly, I'll walk through the bill and describe how this would work. We would establish an oversight committee that would govern the pay-for-performance pool, and you can see that in Section 2, Subdivision 2, what the oversight committee would look like. We would have contracts with the recipients of the funds, the organizations that are out there doing good work, and establish the metrics and determine the outcomes. And then the return on investment from the work that those people are doing would be calculated as well, so that after we determine that they have accomplished the outcomes we wanted, we'll actually calculate the return. And this is hard dollars, members. This is actual numbers that we can book in state government that would then go and replenish the pay-for-performance pool. And that pay-for-performance pool is created through appropriation bonds. And there's a diagram on in your folders that outlines kind of this circular flow. The state creates a pay-for-performance pool by selling appropriation bonds. The private sector weighs in by virtue of their willingness to buy the bonds, so there's some accountability and metrics associated with that. From that performance pool, then, we reward and pay the organizations that are signed up to produce those outcomes when they achieve them. And then the savings from those programs, the actual savings to state government, are booked to pay off the appropriation bonds. So it's a mechanism that provides accountability, confidence to taxpayers, and opportunity for the best organizations to actually compete for these pay-for-performance dollars. So this bill doesn't define exactly who would receive them. It sets up the mechanism within state government to actually do this. And then the decision about what organizations would receive these funds is a downstream activity. Just to pique your curiosity a little bit, some of the obvious organizations and types of organizations that would fit are things like workforce development, where we can track jobs and tax revenues back to the state, avoided costs in health and human services and corrections and the like, perhaps early literacy, perhaps homelessness, perhaps even higher ed. I think you can see all kinds of possibilities here where we wouldn't pay directly for inputs, but we would wait and actually see the outcomes from those organizations and the expenditures we put to them. So that, in a nutshell, is the concept. And if I could, I'd like to have Steve Rothschild, who is the founder of Twin Cities Rise and the person who has built all of the very broad public support for this bill, to maybe go one layer deeper behind his thinking and how he envisions this working. And then we do have some testifiers. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Rothschild. If you could just identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Steve Rothschild. I'm the president of an organization called Invest in Outcomes. And also, as Representative Downey indicated, I am affiliated with Twin Cities Rise, where I'm also the chair of the board.
Oh, maybe.
I'm just going to interrupt here and officially call the meeting to order now that we have a quorum. Sorry to interrupt. Did anyone get a chance to review the minutes? Representative Scalzi.
Mr. Chair, I would move approval of the minutes of March 16th.
Representative Scalzi moves approval of the minutes of March 16th. All those in favor, please
aye.
Signify.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay. Minutes are approved. Okay, we'll take a second now. Representative Murray has a motion to make. Representative Murray.
Madam Chair, I would move House File 681 be recommended to pass and be referred to the State Gov Finance Committee.
Okay. Representative Murray moves House File 681 be recommended to pass and be referred to the State Government Finance Committee. Did you want to go back to you, Mr. Rothschild?
Oh, thank you very much, Madam Chair. This bill kind of evolved out of a great need that's facing the state that I think you're all aware of, and that is if you look out at the state's long-term economic forecast done by the state economist, the estimation is that health care costs are going to continue to grow at twice the rate of state revenues. Now, the implications of that are that state spending for things other than K through 12 education will virtually disappear over the next 20 years. That amount was $6 billion in 2010, and it could go to zero in about 22 years if, in fact, that trend persists. So how do we make up the difference? How do we, if that were to happen, we're not only cutting into the fat and into the muscle, but we're into the bone. $6 billion could fall to $4 billion or perhaps $3 billion. Where do we make it up? How do we provide services to high-performing social enterprise organizations, mostly nonprofits in this state? The government isn't going to be able to solve the problem. Philanthropy can't solve the problem. You could take all the assets of all the foundations in Minnesota, and they wouldn't be able to touch the size of this problem. The only sector left that has the capacity to help deal with this issue is the private sector, investors. And by investors, I'm talking about individuals, foundations, banks, and the like. Now, why would they be interested in this? they'd be interested in investing just like they are in commercial ideas if the return on investment that the social enterprises could develop by virtue of their social actions was greater than the cost to the state of borrowing the money. And we believe, and Twin Cities Rise, as Representative Downey suggested, is an example of where that's already occurring and has been occurring for 13 years. It's our belief that there are many nonprofits and social enterprises in the state that are creating a return on the investment that they now spend to provide services above the cost to the state of borrowing money. And in doing so, we have the potential to bring in many millions of dollars over time, perhaps even a multiple of that, to try to fill part of this gap. So in effect, what this bill does is provide incremental dollars that don't cost the taxpayer a nickel. Don't cost the taxpayer a nickel. The cost is, as Representative Downey suggested, of paying back the bonds is left to the nonprofits for creating value to the state by increasing sales and income taxes and saving public subsidies and other public costs by virtue of their interventions. And it wouldn't be paid unless there's demonstrated outcome. The opportunities here for the for each of the stakeholders are quite broad. For nonprofits that are high performing, because those would be the ones that qualify, they would have the opportunity to grow to scale and to reach more worthy individuals in a more productive way. For the state shifts its risk from itself to the providers, because the providers are only getting paid upon performance on these incremental dollars. And for the investor, it's another investment opportunity for them, much like any other one that they might view. So we see this as a win-win-win opportunity with very little risk for the state and a lot of upside.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay.
We do have a couple of testifiers, if that would make sense, or if you prefer to go to questions, I'd defer to your discretion on that.
Well, why don't we see if we have any introductory questions? No, it doesn't look like it, so we'll go ahead with witnesses then. Good morning. Welcome to the committee, and if you could just identify yourself for the tape.
Certainly. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Bell. I appreciate the opportunity to give some brief testimony in support of the Human Capital Performance Bonds Demonstration Project. Over the past 8 years, I have, as the chair of the previous chair of the Metropolitan Council, I had an opportunity to come up to the legislature many times providing testimony and listening to testimony regarding concepts of pay for performance. And I am pleased to state that the human capital performance bonds are really the first example that brings this idea, this concept, I think, into a sharper focus. They will provide real solutions to the state and taxpayer, and it provides a mechanism to monetize the benefit to the state of activities and services that are provided by nonprofits. Second, and I think equally important, they have the chance to help nonprofits rethink and refocus their services and their operations, moving from focusing on counting and measuring inputs to really focusing and delivering meaningful, tangible, unambiguous outcomes. As Mr. Rothschild said, the way that the project or the demonstration project is structured, there is no risk to the state. A pool would be established, but funds from the pool would not be released until there is demonstrated, and this point cannot be overstated, demonstrated unambiguous financial benefit to the state. And finally, Madam Chair, it would be my hope that this idea would provide a small island of bipartisan agreement and the ability of a working relationship across the political spectrum for an effort that I think well deserves it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bell. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Smith. If you could just please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dane Smith, President of Growth and Justice. We're a policy research organization that advances smart public investments aimed at broadening prosperity and that sustain both business and job growth and economic justice and fairness. We believe this pilot project for human capital performance bonds promises to do just that, to broaden prosperity by attracting new private and public investment to those human service interventions that can be measured and shown most effective in building or rebuilding human capital and also improving lives. The proposal has attracted an impressive array of support across a broad ideological spectrum, and it promises to generate the kind of catalytic change that will lead to a constructive redesign of the way our governments, our foundations, and nonprofits are managing their resources to become more productive. There just aren't that many concepts, as Mr. Bell suggested, that have people saying this is a good conservative idea, and also that this is a good progressive idea. And the progressive dimension it brings can't be emphasized enough. This proposal reinforces the truth that human service spending, and it's often described as spending, that much of it actually is an important form of economic investment that benefits all of us. We just need to do a better job of finding the most effective forms of this investment, and this bill shows great promise in doing just that. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Mr. Bell or Mr. Smith? We do have another witness I have on the list, Mr. Fink, United Way. Oh, sorry, Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess this would be for Mr. Smith or Mr. Bell. I guess what I'm intrigued by this idea, but one of the concerns I have is that when you start to monetize certain outcomes and you pay based on certain outcomes occurring, you have to make sure that the outcomes that you're measuring are the most important ones. And you also have to make sure that those who are paid for delivering those outcomes don't have any influence in determining what outcomes get paid, because there will be a tendency for anybody who has a financial stake in it to try to seek the outcomes that are easiest to achieve at the least cost, and to create pressure to make more difficult outcomes not part of the equation. And I guess I don't know if either of you has any background experience or information about this, but anything that has to do with, you know, the public sector is inherently it is susceptible to influence through the legislative process, through political pressure, through other things. And I guess I wonder if you've given thought to how you wall off the measurements that you're seeking enough from outside influence that the financial stake that that some organizations will have in it aren't felt in determining what the right outcomes are.
Mr. Bell?
Madam Chair, as Mr. Rothschild said, there will be a board that will be established. And I think your point, Representative, is a very important one, because I think the integrity and the autonomy of that board is a key linchpin to this concept, and that the legislature and the public would have to be sure that that is truly an autonomous board. In terms of your related question of additional benefits that would result from this, and would they be the most important ones? From my perspective, that's an important question, but the real question is would it provide a return on invested capital buy the bonds or buy the state, that the money would go to the ABC organization. The ABC organization would engage in activities, and would that pay for the interest and a return to the state? And if it does that, it will be deemed as successful. Now, there'll be other ancillary benefits that may be more important even than the actual dollar return to the state. But the focus of the demonstration project will be to look at those ancillary benefits, but to really say, is there a meaningful, identifiable, unambiguous return to the state for the invested capital? It brings market mechanisms and market discipline to human service investments. And I believe the way that Mr. Rothschild has structured the demonstration project will provide that degree of autonomy and assurance that there will be an actual return to capital investment, or to the investment in the bonds. It won't be capital investment, actually. It will be investment in the program.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Smith.
Representative Winkler. I actually think your question is a very good one. I think I want to emphasize that this is a pilot project. There is a general consensus that we don't do enough to measure performance in human services. We need to try this, I think. But the notion that we can impose this kind of scheme on all human services, or that this is an effort to do that, that's not what's happening here. It's a pilot project.
Okay, thank you. I guess it's Ms. Fink is next on the list. I thought it was a Mr. Fink. Is she here? Representative Downey, do you know if there's a Marsha Fink here? Is she on your list? Okay, we'll take the next witness then. There's one more witness though?
From Aspen Council 5.
Oh, okay. If you'd like to come up and talk? And if you could just identify yourself for the tape.
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Thorson from AFSCME Council 5, and appreciate the opportunity to share, I guess, some questions and concerns about this interesting proposal. I think it starts with a kernel of a good idea, which is to take periodic, detailed evaluation of programs and to assess their value. And I know in those evaluations then can be used to adjust, increase, decrease, or adjust other programming levels. And in Washington State, I believe there's a similar detailed review of selected functions as part of a legislative audit process. But in Washington State, it's a process that is slow, costly, and not especially appropriate for an annual program review. The returns on investments claimed by the program providers tend to be greatly exaggerated and have not been subjected to the kind of analysis that they're proposing. The financing mechanism for this proposal makes it seem to be free and at no cost, but it's actually a more expensive approach for delivering service because it borrows funds for program operations. The state budget costs are created to pay back the loans in years 1, 2, and beyond, yet the benefit, which I believe is real, might not occur for 10, 12 years or a couple decades out. And on the front end, too, there's an initial substantial overhead cost that can be created by the need to pay interest and to perform the detailed program evaluations in an operation like this. I think a simpler, more effective approach would be to appropriate funds each year for programs and then institute a similar periodic evaluation that, again, can be used to increase, decrease, or adjust programming in these areas. Another question or concern is the financing. It's not a capital financing. Again, it's borrowing funds for program operations. And that's inconsistent with the state's focus for borrowing for bricks and mortar and for capital projects. It may also require higher cost appropriation or moral obligation bonds because it's not of a capital nature. That may be a 6.5% rate or not a 4% rate. That would be a significant expansion of the state's current bonding program. Again, the proposal is it's a debt-oriented way to pay for social programming, and it's not to say that there aren't benefits for the provision of these social services, but it's a departure, and I think a costly departure for the way that the state and local governments engage in providing these services today.
Thank you. Representative Bornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Thorson, and thank you for your testimony. And, you know, I agree with you about the financing source, but I was also, or the implications of that, but I was also wondering if AFSCME has any concerns about the language on page 2, subdivision 3 around contracting. I don't think it's a direct path towards outsourcing, but you know, I always have my antennae up about these kinds of things. I know we've worked together on issues around MnDOT and outsourcing of jobs there. So I was just wondering if you had any issues in addition to your testimony about the financing mechanism about this pilot program potentially leading to some other things that you may be opposed to in terms of outsourcing.
Well, the general answer would be yes.
Mr. Thorson.
Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein, the general answer would be yes, and quite frankly, this proposal is something that's new to us. We're actually looking at it with fresh eyes, and we would appreciate an opportunity to speak with the supporters of the bill about some of these issues further and be able to comment on that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for this witness? Is there anyone else in the audience that needs to testify in House File 681 would like to testify? Okay, then I think we'll bring Representative Downey up for some concluding thoughts and see if there are any questions for Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if I could, I think Mr. Rothschild might have a couple of answers to the previous questions as well to clarify the exact provisions of the bill and how some of these bonding mechanisms work, and even Representative Winkler's question, if that's all right.
Sure. Mr. Rothschild?
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, your question is a good one. The organizations wouldn't be asked to provide return on investment information. They would be asked by the Oversight Board to provide data that constitutes outcomes that are agreed upon by the board itself in consultation with the state, obviously state OMB, and the organizations to ensure that we're measuring the right outcomes in this case. From that, the board would hire economists, much like we have, to provide the information that we're working on right now, to develop the return on investment to ensure that we're using the same standards across all organizations and that we would have fairness. Your question about organizations trying to work with the easiest people as opposed to the most difficult people, if I understood it correctly, is a concern, but I think it's less of a concern than in point of fact the way state pays for services today. Most social service organizations are given a cost to individuals to work per individual or per output, if you will. And the incentive there is to work with individuals have the fewest number of barriers. You have a fixed cost. You want to make sure you stay below that cost as you work with them. In this case, because organizations are going to share in the value that they create, there's an incentive to work with more difficult people. People that have had previous felony convictions or have been on drugs or have been homeless cost the state more money and therefore there's more opportunity for cost avoidance. And so we think that this is going to flip the creaming issue on its head and be in favor of this kind of approach. And we have an example in Twin Cities Rise, where we do work with 80% of the men are ex-felons, and the cost avoidance to the state is quite high. If we were working with people who didn't have those obstacles, the cost benefit, if you will, of change wouldn't be as great. With respect to some of the questions that were asked about, I think we dealt with ROI being exaggerated. That's not going to be up to the individual organizations. This is borrowing money, but it's not borrowing money for money that the state now has to spend. This is not affecting current allocations of these organizations. This is borrowing money from the private sector at a very low cost, and the underwriters that we have dealt with say the cost should be about 4% on this money, for money that they now don't have and the state doesn't have. And we expect that the benefits will start to accrue to the state not 10 or 12 years out, but immediately, because the money isn't given to the organization to initiate work with their clients. It's only given to them at the point when they have an outcome that's mutually agreed to, and the state is already starting to benefit from increased taxes and lower public subsidies. So we think there could be the opportunity for positive arbitrage, or if you will, a profit for the state, which would in effect lower the cost of government. We don't see this as an expensive overhead operation whatsoever. There will be some work required up front by state government agencies to track individuals. And what is important here is that individuals that are clients of these organizations will be tracked on the basis of their Social Security numbers or through other means, so that we can identify and attribute the actual income increases and the actual savings to the state as a result of the actions of the nonprofit. And that will serve as the evaluation of this pilot. It won't be based on estimates. It'll be based on actual data.
Thank you very much. Is there any other discussion or questions on this bill? Seeing none, I think we're ready to move on for a vote. Representative Murray renews his motion that House File 681 be recommended to pass and be referred to Committee on State Government Finance. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion does prevail.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. It's Representative Westrom here.
Recess for just a second. Representative Westrom is on his way down.
I would take a call.
Theoretically.
Oh my God, it would be such a relief. I'm joking. I do need to come back in my life.
It's not like you can.
So anyway, you're
so you can talk. So you can talk about it afterwards.
For critique.
Yeah.
They're usually very good. But my only criticism is
it's a little long.
It's just relaxed.
It's
That's a good thing. So anyway, you're saying
back to order as we try to track down the author of the bill. I am a co-author, and I think it's sufficient to get started. Representative Sanders, would you like to make the motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'll move that House File 1074 be recommended, passed, and sent to the Commerce Committee.
Okay, Representative Sanders moves that House File...
No, you go ahead. I pass.
Representative Sanders moves that House File 1074 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce. Welcome to the committee. If we could, you want to just start talking about the bill? We'll say hi to Representative Western when he comes in.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mary Hartnett, and I'm with the Commission of Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. We're a governor-appointed commission that advocates for and with people that are deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing for equal access and opportunity in healthcare, education, employment, access to public services, and technology. And I want to thank Representative Westrum for introducing this major piece of civil rights legislation. And I'll wait here. And
better late than never, Representative Westrum. Why don't you tell us about your bill? We've already moved it.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Any questions? Just trying to maximize the minutes in the office. Members, Madam Chair, House File 1074 would extend an advisory commission and allow them to help implement the accessible electronic websites and other electronic data that our state had passed a law in 2009. I was a co-author with Chair Hilty then, and we passed significant and monumental legislation that has us as a state leading the way, but also practicing what we preach, in that we make electronic documents accessible for everybody in the state, sighted and unsighted, deaf and hard of hearing. As they set up their websites, we ask them to take all of those things into considerations. And let me just back up a little bit. Regulated Industries, about 6 or 7 years ago, we passed an approval for using the TAM funds, which is a line item on your phone bill that allows access for hard of hearing, deaf and hard of hearing, to get phones as well as other features out of that fund. We felt it was consistent with that intent to also help fund other measures that help make accessibility an option, or more of an option, more available for citizens in the state who have visual impairments. And so that's a relatively recent funding source that has been used for several years now. What this bill will do will extend the sunset of the Advisory Commission to help advise the implementations of the accessible electronic records and documents that we passed in 2009. And let me quell any fears that it's some monumental task that's going on out there. It is not. It is not overly complicated. It is achievable, but it is not. It has not always been done in the state with our electronic websites and the data that we put forward. And many times, it's just a matter of planning up ahead of time. What kind of documents you put out there or what kind of websites you put out there. And so if you plan ahead of time, it makes it fairly easy, fairly affordable, fairly routine. But if you go down the wrong road, it makes it very cumbersome, very problematic, and potentially much more expensive. And so the idea is on the front end, when we're requesting bids, requesting design and proposals, let's set it up right, which doesn't add terribly much cost if you do it the right way. And there is technology that makes websites and other things accessible if you have the right match put together in the front end. If you wait and do it at the other end, in many cases it makes it non-accessible, or other cases it does make it much more clumsy and complicated to make it accessible. And so the idea with the advisory committee is to help work with OET and the Department of Administration in setting this up so they know what they're doing. Because not everybody who doesn't deal with accessibility issues on the website knows exactly what you're talking about. But I can give you some examples in my own life. Word documents, for instance, read very well on my computer. PDFs, if they're original PDFs, read very well. But if somebody scans a PDF and thinks, oh, that's a PDF, so it reads, it doesn't read well because the computer and the speech, in my instance, looks at that scanned PDF as a photo rather than text or words or objects on the page that are to make up words. And so that's just a simple example of things that I often work through, but it's an example to kind of put a tangible face on how some of this accessibility works. And so with that, Madam Chair, members, I'm happy to answer questions. Mary Hartnett can help give you some more insight into the Advisory Council and what good work they have been doing and working on implementing the 2009 law, and this would extend the committee for two more years to work on getting that stuff implemented and done.
Ms. Hartnett?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I want to just walk through briefly. Walk through briefly the work that's been the great work that's been done over the last 2 years. As I said, it's considered this. I pushed the wrong button. Consider this to be a major piece of civil rights legislation for people that are deaf, hard of hearing, deaf, blind, and all people with disabilities. The legislation, as you said, passed in 2009. Funding was allocated. An advisory committee that is representative of people with disabilities and CIOs of three branches of state government got together to implement a plan, monitor the progress, and everybody learned from each other. IT CIOs, chief information officers, frequently don't have contact with people with disabilities, and they experienced what it was like and heard firsthand what it was like not to be able to access government services. It wasn't just documents, it wasn't just websites, but also devices that were purchased by state government. So we submitted two progress reports. I served on that committee. That advisory committee sunsets in June of this year. And what's happened so far? The Legislative Coordinating Commission, probably the most visible thing that you've seen, developed a pilot for captioning all webcasts on floor sessions and committee hearings. Our commission created a lot of content in American Sign Language, which is one of the tenets of the standards, and created a course on teaching people how to caption their videos. It's an online course that anybody can take, and any citizen can take. It doesn't just apply to state agencies. Admin, Department of Admin and OET began to integrate in technology standards into their operations. The Department of Administration is here and would like to say a word about the complexity of the work that they did and how deeply they went down to make sure that contracts have accessibility requirements in all of in all contracts going forward, and they integrated accessibility standards into enterprise professional service contracts. And I'm going to let Kent Allen come and.
Hello.
Thank you, Mary.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Kent Allen. I'm the Chief Procurement Officer for the state. I had the opportunity to serve on the steering committee for the project that's been underway for the last 2 years. And actually, my colleague, Betsy Hayes, has been the chair of the advisory committee that we're talking about this morning. I should start by saying that this process to date has really been an excellent example of stakeholders working together and reaching some very impressive outcomes following lots of meetings, subcommittees, occasional disagreements, but ultimately persistence and mutual respect. The one outcome I wanted to focus on briefly here this morning is this procurement matrix, and I believe you have it in your packet. You won't really be able to see it very well on the screen. But the concept is one that I'd like you to understand. The federal government and others who have implemented accessibility standards have really struggled with the issue of how you incorporate that into procurement. Generally, the models that people have come up with have either been too inflexible to be practicable, or they've been so flexible that there's really no teeth in them. And one of our working groups devoted a considerable amount of energy into trying to come up with a better solution, and we really think they found it. I think their primary conclusion is that this isn't a situation where one size fits all. So what the working group developed is really six distinct evaluation methodologies that you would use in different procurements depending upon the market considerations involved. So you'd use different tools depending upon the availability of accessible products in the marketplace, the amount of competition among vendors with accessible products, cost differentials, and so forth. We really see this as kind of a breakthrough in creative thinking around procurement of accessible technology. Training and implementation is underway in the state on these tools. The federal government and some other states have expressed interest because, again, I think we're solving a problem that people have struggled with and haven't solved successfully before. Thanks for this short chance to talk about the opportunities that we've had and our success with this procurement matrix.
Thank you, Mr. Allen, and we are just now getting the handout, so if you could stick around in case members have questions. We do have a couple of questions right now. I think we'll take them and then move on to other witnesses. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a couple of questions I have here. We're extending the sunset on this. And I guess reading the overview here, we're putting this into statute where before it was in session law. So that's why all the language is here. I was just wondering about that, is why all the language if we're just extending the sunset. But the other question I have is this an increase in funding or is this a decrease in funding from what they're currently already getting? I guess that'd be my first question, then I have a follow-up.
Ms. Hartnett?
Madam Chair, Representative, the project was funded with ARA money, $276,000 for the biennium, and then it was $600,000. So it's actually a little bit less minus the ARA money. So we are trying to be as conservative as we can be, looking at lessons learned over the last 2 years where we should really allocate the funds. So it's an increase in the TAM funds, but it's a decrease in the amount of funding for the startup.
Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
And then I guess the question, if we're extending this, do we, We all love sunsets in things because it's you know, then we can come back and look at them again when the sun sets up and decide whether it's successful or not. But I think this is an important program that I can see how this would help individuals in my family who are hard of hearing and deaf. And so it's just I'm not opposed to it. So I don't take my questions as being that way, but. If this is a necessary program, why are we sunsetting it? If it's because aren't we going to be needing to continue doing this and making sure that we keep up as technology improves down the future? Or, it can by you know, are we going to have it done in 2 years where we'll be able to have accessible and not have to deal with it again?
Ms. Hartnett,
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson. We were trying to be conservative in our approach. We know how tight finances are this legislative session. We believe that the advisory committee takes very seriously its charge, and we'll continue to monitor and come back with more recommendations. I would guess that we may need to extend it again, but we want to report back to you, explain the progress that has been made, and then perhaps. Have it be an ongoing committee with a sunset that's further out, but given the large deficit, we decided to come in shorter term. But we would be, you know, happy to have an extension for another couple of years because, as Representative Downey has a bill that is a consolidation of all of the state IT services, and many of the questions that I've heard that have been raised during the committee have been, is this going to be, a short-term, fix? And so, no, it's a long-term systemic change, and that it'll take at least 6-7 years to really integrate everything into the system, into the process. And if you move, actually go in right now, you'll see, I couldn't fit it onto the screen. I didn't have the technology skills, but you have in your packet the complexity of all of the systems that have to be addressed within Office of Enterprise Technology to really get down there and dig down deep. The green squares that you have are what's been done, and that's a lot of work over the last 2 years. We want all the green squares built. That means that the work is completed. So we'd be happy to entertain looking at a sunset that's further out, but again, we wanted to really be respectful and mindful of how deep in debt all of us are here in the state and come back again and ask at another time. When we hope that the state is more prosperous.
Thank you. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I want to commend Representative Westrom for bringing this bill forward. I think it's an important piece of legislation and accomplishes some good things. I do have a question about some of the broadcasts of legislative sessions. There were some inaccuracies. Some of the remarks that I made became more entertaining than I intended. And just wondering what the procedure is, how these inaccuracies happen.
Ms. Hartnett?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl. The original legislation was for a pilot, and the cost of a what are called CART services or real-time captioning is about $100 an hour. So the Legislative Coordinating Commission decided to try to go with echo captioning, which is about half the cost. And there's Greg Hubinger is here, who oversaw the project. And it was voice recognition software that we rely upon, but a lot of it depends on the skill of the person that's repeating the captions. It's very common in England. It's actually what England uses exclusively. It's not as common in the United States, becoming more common. I believe Greg has more information about this, but actually we did a survey and the accuracy rate has increased dramatically over this next year. During the course of the pilot, it was sketchy and then got much better, but he could speak to this very quickly here.
Mr. Hubinger, would you like to?
Representative Erdahl, maybe you want to refresh our memories.
That's not necessary.
Well, I was just going to say, Representative Westrom, that it's best forgotten, and I'm still trying to explain to my wife anyway.
However, Representative Westrom, if you'd like to talk about it from your perspective, we'd be happy to hear that. Anyway, on to Mr. Hubinger.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Greg Hubinger from the Legislative Coordinating Commission. Our agency or office is responsible for implementing this pilot program. Early in the last session, my name came up in echo captioning as Cuban shirt. So there is there's been a pattern. The funds have been really helpful for us in trying to find innovative and cheaper ways to provide this service. As Ms. Hartnett indicated, the usual rate for having this done by court stenographers is about $100 an hour, and we're trying to explore other ways that can provide this important service more cheaply. And we've been doing it with this pilot program. We've been using echo captioners who are people who listen to what's going on in a floor session or a hearing, repeat it into a computer that converts that to text, which shows up on the on your TV or on your computer monitor. There's an interaction between the echo captioner and the software that's critical for having that be accurate. By the end of the session, we are getting the echo captioners in the 09 session, or the 10 session, to get to about 96% accuracy, which is what the threshold is, we figured out, for people to be able to understand what's being captioned across the screen. This year, for the 11th session, we did another RFP, and we've contracted with another firm to provide captioning for the House, which is a firm based in California. And we seem to be having a lot of success with that. So the competition in the market is working for us. We're trying to find different ways to provide the service.
Okay. Thank you. Representative, you're done, Representative Riddle. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On to the sunset issue, I support this bill. I support the activity, but because this is technology driven, I think one of the nice things about sunset is it forces you to go back and look at legislation. And with the, you know, improvements we've had in technology at such a rate, I think that it's appropriate that we go back and review this and make sure that if we need to improve it or help it, that we do so. So I'm not as concerned with that, and I, if I'm still here, would definitely support this in the future.
Thank you. Do we have other witnesses, it looks like?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to introduce Andrew Palmer.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Palmer.
Madam Chair and the member of the committee, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to give my support for Bill H.R. 1074. My name is Andrew Palmer, and I've been an attorney with the Minnesota Commission for the Deaf, the Blind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesota Center for the last month and a half, and part of my job has been watching live for the last session and the community hearing from the legislative website, and it supports real-time captioning prior to 2009 that would not been possible. And I've been going to legislative assistance to make appointments with legislators for members from our community. And I'm noticing that I've seen a lot of legislative assistants watching the floor session and community hearing with caption on and sound off because they don't want to bother everybody else. And what we call an electronic curb cut. It's like a sidewalk curb cut. It helps people in wheelchairs, but it also helps parents with strollers and bicyclists and shoppers. So it benefits not only people in wheelchairs, but more broad people in the community. So I'm here to ask the committee to improve the accessibility of the government service. The advisory committee needs to continue their great work and oversee the implementation of the work and the combination of employees in the state government with disabilities who are accessibility experts and chief information officers has helped make a strong foundation. We need the work to continue and the bill was supported. And I would like to thank you for your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Palmberg. Anyone have questions? Are there other witnesses as well?
Sir, no. Madam Chair, members of the committee. I just want to add that this has been an incredible process. We went into this with the Office of Enterprise Technology, the LCC, and Department of Administration really knowing very little about this subject. And they've taken it on with passion and with care and bringing everything that they had to the table. So I am so impressed. This has really been an amazing process for the disability community and for state government. So, and we had all three branches of state government sitting on at the table, and the courts have made changes as a result, and as has the LCC, and we actually, our commission gave everybody an award that's been involved with this, so we're very pleased.
Thank you very much. Does anyone have any final questions? Okay, seeing no questions, Representative Sanders renews his motion that House File 1074 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Regulatory Reform. All those in favor, please signify by saying.
Chair.
Oh, sorry, Representative West.
Mary is just informing me that she thinks it's actually probably rather state government finance.
Madam Chair, actually, I just spoke with John Reich from Mr. Reich from Commerce, and he believes that it should be a state government utilities.
State government finance.
Madam Chair, John
Welcome
Reich,
to the committee.
Director of Government Affairs for the Commerce Department. As I understand it, the TAM fund is under the purview of Representative McNamara's committee, which is House Energy, Finance, and Natural Resources. Oh, okay. That's where the commerce budget has been placed. And so I think I defer to Representative Sanders, the vice chair of the Commerce Committee. And if it should go there, then by all means. If it's a budget consideration, however, I suggest the House Energy Finance Committee.
I didn't hear the last part.
I'm sorry, the House, if it's a budget matter, then I'd suggest the House Energy Finance Committee for Representative McNamara.
Okay, would you like to withdraw or amend your motion then, Representative Sanders?
Yes, Madam Chair, I will amend my motion that House File 1074 be passed and referred to the House Energy Finance Committee.
Okay, Representative Sanders moves that House File 1074 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Energy Finance Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion does prevail.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. Thank you very
much. Committee members.
Next on the agenda is House File 962.
Good, Larry. Give me a
Madam Chair, are you ready?
Representative McFarland.
Yes, I would like to move that we pass House File 962 to be moved to the Health and Human Services Policy Committee.
Representative McFarland moves that House File 962 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Health and Human Services Policy Committee. Representative Howes, to your bill.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative McFarland, I guess I would like to know why it would go to Health and Human Services Policy, what jurisdiction they would have over sales.
Representative Howes, we received a note from Representative Gottwald saying that he wanted to see the bill.
That's different. Okay.
Did you want to, it looks like you have an amendment here. Would you like to move that as well?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative McFarland.
Chair, I'd like to move the A11-0148 amendment.
Representative McFarland moves the A11-0148 amendment to your amendment. Representative Howes.
Okay, Madam Chair and members, I'm going to try to explain it as briefly as I can. and then I'm sure you're going to have questions and we can get into more detail, and I have the expert with me. But what I'm trying to do with this bill is simply give municipalities more options, and actually this amendment, which is now the bill, gives them really more authority in how they can look at suspending licenses. And I think it's fair to do it this way. If you look on line 4, it says the licensing authority may take any alternative authorized enforcement action that the authority deems fit. So if the authority deems fit to look at this in a different way, in that maybe the violation was caused by, and it says a sincere mistake. We think we may change those words. We're not 100% sure yet. The League of Cities is very good with this amendment and how the bill looks now, but we might change it to a good faith mistake or something, but our legal people told me that good faith is not in law. Representative Winkler would probably know that. So we went with this language.
Definitely not in law.
Thank you. So that's why we used sincere mistake, and I was told that is in law. So with that, that's the very simple part of the bill. We're not we don't have any alternative motives. We're just trying to make it so that if an employee makes an honest mistake, are we going to shut the business down because an employee made an honest mistake? There are those out there that may do these things on purpose, and those are the ones we should go after, but not the ones that an employee simply made an honest mistake. And I'm going to use this example, maybe I shouldn't, but Wally the beer man, he did not shut down the Target Center, even though he was met with a sting operation. So I think what's fair is fair in all lines of sales. With that, we'll stand for any questions. I have Mr. Krogman here that deals with a lot of this. So if you've got real tough questions, he can answer.
Okay. Does anyone have questions to the A110148 amendment? Does anyone need to testify to the amendment? Okay. Seeing no questions? Oh, Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wondered who perhaps will decide what an honest mistake is.
Representative House.
Madam Chair, that would be the municipality. They would look at does the business have a process where they train their employees, coach their employees, tell their employees not to make a mistake, and maybe create their own sting operation within the business to catch their employee and say, you made a mistake, we can't do that. So the authority, I'll use the City of Walker, would make that decision, not some outside entity.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions to the amendment? Okay, seeing no questions or testimony, all those in favor of the A110148 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Back to the bill.
Madam Chair, I think I explained the bill when I explained the amendment.
Mr. Krogman, did you want to say a few words?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Krogman. I'm with the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. We've got about 700 members statewide. As a group, they own and operate supply over 2,000 of the state's convenience stores, 3,500 convenience stores. I simply would like to reaffirm what Representative Powell said here. There's no hidden agenda here. There's nothing that we're looking to do. This came about because the existing law calls for a hearing. It says no suspension or penalty may take effect until the licensee has a hearing before the licensing authority. That hearing turned out to be simply an affirmation of that the violation occurred. Several of our members called us and said, I've gone before the city council, explained that it was simply a mistake, something like the person behind the counter didn't have her glasses on or added the numbers wrong, and invariably someone on the council says, boy, I understand that. It's a people mistake, but our ordinance says we must suspend. We don't have an option. This amendment, the bill now, would give the licensing authority, the city council and county board, the flexibility to determine whether or not it was an honest mistake. And even if they determined that it was an honest mistake, under this, they could still suspend the license. Is whatever they determine the appropriate enforcement action is. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Krogman. At this point, do we have any questions for the author or Mr. Krogman?
Madam Chair.
Representative Beard.
I don't know if Mr. Krogman or Representative House can answer this, but are we given to understand then by inference from your comments that that state law precludes them from having any discretion now? In other words, do we in statute prescribe what their ordinance must be so that there is a second or third offense, the councils have their hands tied? Because I understand what you're trying to do here is to give them statutory authority to have discretion and to have some alternative means of enforcement or something to that effect. So are we to understand that if this bill does not pass, they have their hands tied by the state legislature then?
Mr. Krogman. Oh, Mr. House, Representative House.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Beard, yes, it simply says that the under the administrative penalty of, I'll read one sentence, $250 must be imposed, and the licensee's authority to sell tobacco at that location must be suspended for not less than 7 days. So they must suspend under any circumstances, but they can also suspend for 60 days or 6 months, which we're not touching that at all.
All right.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just shedding a little bit of past experience on this, the state statute is very, very clear that notices need to be sent for violators, and what happens is the individuals are invited to come in and testify before the city council, and basically the question that's asked is, did the offense occur, yes or no? Well, yes, it did. Thank you. That's where we're at under statute. There is no permissive language in there that allows for, as being suggested here, serious mistake or some of those types of languages. One of the things that we had done in my experience is we had adopted some of the language that's was in the original bill of requiring the retailers to be able to go out and have a training program and to interact with the enforcement agencies on that in our community. And then what would happen would be they would be notified that there would be semi-annual compliance checks, aka some refer to them as sting operations, but again, statute puts that burden of compliance on the licensing issuer, which would be the city in this case. And so what we would end up doing would be going out and starting with the process, and if you had one violation, here's what it was, two violations, here's what it was, three violations. And I would suspect that municipalities may be encouraged by the flexibility that the law would now provide for some of those, if you will, unforeseen circumstances that may have occurred, that you say, maybe we want to look at it. I think it's a step in the right direction. Otherwise, municipalities have basically held hearings that say, did you or did you not? Yes, we did. Well, then that's where it's at. And the same thing, the other topic, but liquor is the same way.
So, Representative O'Driscoll, so since you do have experience as mayor, so if there were an elderly person or something that couldn't see the numbers or for some reason that didn't matter, there was no...
Madam Chair, that is correct. The only question that's permissible under state statute that the licensing authority can ask is, did or did not the violation occur? And what happens is, in the testimony, most of the violators will come in and say, yep, on this day it happened. We're not arguing that it happened, but we're saying, here are the issues that surrounded that. And we say, you know what? We're done when you say it happened, because that's the extent that statute gives us as the enforcing and issuing authority.
Okay, thank you. Representative Simon.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if Mr. Krogman, maybe you could talk a little bit about the scope here. How big of an issue is this? You say you have 700 members. How many of your members have been affected by this? How many of the stores? Are they passing the sting operations or are they not? If you have a sense of the numbers, I think that would be helpful.
Mr. Krogman?
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, I don't have numbers. I hear about this when they call and say, here's what happened to me. I've heard from members that suspensions of 10 to 30 days have cost them several thousand dollars. Documentation of that is only if they send it to me. I don't have numbers, but I've heard from enough members, and in fact a couple of members have contacted their senators and said, please, if there's something we can do about this, that's where this eventually came from. Local ordinances are, in some cases, many cases, much more stringent than state law. They'll require suspension of the licensee on the second violation of anywhere from 10, 30 days. There's one that says it'll be suspended for the remainder of the license period or 90 days, whichever is greater. And these are on second and third violations. So there's some ordinances that are much, much more stringent than state law. But this amendment doesn't change that. It simply says those issuing authorities, city councils, would have some flexibility to consider something other than suspension.
Representative Simon.
Just a quick follow-up. I think we all agree, retailers agree, everyone agrees we want to get at, you know, underage youth smoking for a lot of reasons. I don't have any amendment here today, but just theoretically, would you have any problem tying this language to a provision that said, you know, it would sunset if there was an increase in teen smoking or underage smoking? Or in other words, this would only go into effect if a certain level of teen smoking were maintained. Would you have any problem just theoretically to tying the privilege that's in this language with some outcome in terms of underage smoking in Minnesota?
Representative Howes?
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, I'd love to work with you on that, and since this is going to Gottwald's committee, I'll talk to the chair there about that and see what he thinks, and I'll talk to some other folks. I'm not going to just jump up and say yes, but I certainly will look at it, and if that were to be the case, I would like to look at least a 2 to 4 year sunset to give us time, not a 1 year. I don't think that's enough time, but I'd certainly be open to that.
Okay. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm kind of confused because this is the third violation. It has the administrative fine of $250, and then you could be suspended. That's the third violation. I dealt with this in the city council for many years. It was usually corrected after the first violation. Usually the owner or the manager or whatever, if they're going to have these stings coming in, and they know it and everybody knows it, usually they correct it immediately. I'm just shocked that we could have a bill that says a sincere mistake. I have no idea how we would enforce that. How would a city enforce that? It just looks like good work for lawyers to me.
Senator House?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, the municipality can still do whatever it wants under the current law. This just says the municipality can have mercy on the 68-year-old person that sold to a minor and not punish the business because the 68-year-old person was maybe tired. I shouldn't be picking on a 68-year-old person. I'm getting close myself. But it just gives them the option. If they don't want to, they don't have to. If they want to be the meanest group of city council people in the world, they can still do that. But if they want to have a heart and say, you know what, folks, this looks like, how about a dumb mistake instead of an honest mistake? We're going to give this person a break.
Representative Scalzi.
It just sounds to me like we're going to pass a law because something happened in Walker. And I'm troubled by that because every city council that enforces this ordinance takes it very seriously. It's not like they're mean. You have to enforce the laws because there's always somebody that wants to go a little further than the law currently allows. And this is the only time they would suspend the authority to sell tobacco is after at the third offense. It's not like you can't do some training and corrections and tell your employees, you know, knock it off, because there's going to be stings. So everyone be watching. I just don't know that how you would ever enforce something based upon what somebody might consider to be a dumb mistake. And you know, if somebody knows somebody in a small town, I can see where this ordinance like this could be applied very unevenly. I just think it would it would be very difficult for a city to be fair to all of its residents if they're going to be arbitrarily deciding what's dumb or sincere or age-related. Or, I mean, if somebody can't see, they should not be selling tobacco.
Well, Representative House.
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, maybe I used the 68-year-old person wrongly, and maybe that they couldn't see. I misspoke there, too. But there are cases where the licenses are suspended on the second violation. There are instances where a business may be stung three times in a week because you have an over-aggressive sheriff or chief of police. That aside, if they violated, yes, they did something wrong. And again, this does not tell municipalities they have to do anything differently. If they want, they can look at it. Instead of, like Representative O'Driscoll said, when you answer the question, yes, it was a violation, the discussion is now over and it goes to the jury, no. Sometimes there are extenuating circumstances that are serious and debatable, and it just lets them do it if they want to. They don't have to.
Okay, we have at least a half dozen people that want to testify on this. I do have several member questions. Representative Winkler, did you need to ask right now?
Well, yeah, thank
Representative
you.
Winkler.
I'd just like to understand the standards a little bit. It's my understanding that there is that in 46112 subdivision 2, there is a state minimum standard for licenses and penalties, and that currently cities or towns may add penalties that are stronger than the state minimum. Is that how it works? We got to have it on yes or no.
Madam Chair.
Representative Powers.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. The follow-up then is what the bill as amended would do is allow municipalities to adopt a penalty that would be lower than the state standard is if the municipality or if the action is based on a sincere mistake or whatever language you change it to, and if the company has a different policy. So as I read the bill as amended, it's more flexibility, but right now we have flexibility to exceed the state standard, and this bill would allow flexibility for the municipality to impose violations that are less than the current state standard. Is that what the bill does?
Do you want to talk on that?
Mr. Krogman?
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, I see what you mean. When we looked at it, we looked at the language the other way and said, if a local ordinance currently says suspend on the second violation, this would give the city council licensing authority to actually revoke instead of suspend. It does that. The other side, as you said, is that it perhaps could reduce that third violation in state law, much less their own ordinance, to something less. And I guess more than willing to put something in there that says you can't do that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. Representative O'Driscoll?
I know that you'd like to get the other testifiers, but I may be able to help clear up some confusion, Madam Chair, on what might be these kinds of circumstances that you may bump up against. Two come to mind right now. One is in our municipality, what we did is we required a training program, and many of the retailers certainly want to comply with the program because the media is right there wanting to know who didn't comply and their name gets out there. So they're very protective of their business name and their reputation as a proprietor in the community. What may happen is in some circumstances you may have an employee who is not as diligent and compliant with company policy for various reasons, and one may be because they have a tiff with their employer, a particular manager, and boy, wouldn't this be a nice way to be able to draw some attention in a retaliatory way. How is that going to be able to be something that's on the shoulders of the proprietor when an employee is making a conscious decision on those types of things? Second is, many times you'll be able to have card readers where you'll be able to swipe the driver's license, and many of the retailers would like to have that because it's typically a foolproof system, but it's not 100% foolproof. the information is updated from the Department of Transportation and Public Safety. I should say not transportation, but public safety. There could be other issues where the system is temporarily invalidated and other kinds of things that are on beyond the control of the retailer. And so you're kind of caught in a catch-22 with that employee situation. So those are a couple of maybe extenuating circumstances that might arise in a where, again, you come forward, did or did not the event occur, yes, and then it's the comma, but, and there may be some good information behind the comma, but, that would help one to make a decision. I can also tell you that from our experiences, we've been very successful with the training program and reducing the instances of underage sales in both liquor and in tobacco products, and the providers have been very, very interested in wanting to engage and be a part of that as a proactive, upfront, if you will, abating measure to avoid the unnecessary consequences.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, as your witnesses,
Representative House,
are walking up.
Okay, let me just start with them. And to the witnesses, we are supposed to be done at noon. And I know that usually is the time we start losing witnesses, or losing members. If you could keep it to just a minute or two and get your point out quickly, that would be great. Start out with Jennifer O'Rourke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jennifer O'Rourke. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. And as you may know, we're the statewide association up here representing cities at the Capitol. First and foremost, we believe the present law works. But when this bill was introduced last week, we started working with Mr. Krogman and then the author, if you will, on language, trying to figure out if there was a way to accommodate a lot of the interests and issues that are out there. Obviously, this amendment that's before you today really places greater responsibility, if you will, on the City Council, but it also affords some of the greater flexibility that you've talked about already at this table in being able to respond to extenuating circumstances on the retail side of things. We very much appreciate the permissive language and things like the word may that's on line 1.4 in this amendment. We too had concerns with the language sincere mistake and brought forward just the idea of the term good faith. I don't know how that exactly fits into this amendment. I know we visited with Representative Howe, and maybe that's something that can be worked on as this progresses. I stand for any questions.
Thank you. Next we'll have Teresa Leonard and Katie Engman. But did you need to say something, Representative House? I'm sorry.
Well, yeah, Madam Chair, while they're coming up, I wanted to point out, too, that a lot of these violations happen with an employee. Very rarely does that employee ever make that mistake again because it is an entry-level job. Once stung, they usually don't ever do it again. But what happens is there's such a high turnover. You have new employees all the time.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you could just please identify yourself for the record.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Teresa Leonard, and I'm here on behalf of the American Lung Association. And our mission is the prevention and control of lung disease. And with that, that includes preventing youth access and preventing them from starting tobacco. We know that the majority of adult smokers who suffer a lifetime of addiction begin their smoking in their youth years. We feel this bill is a serious step backwards towards our mission and our efforts. We have worked in across the states with volunteers working together to pass local youth access policies. In 1996, only 69% of the tobacco vendors across the state passed a compliance check conducted through the Department of Human Services. That number rose to 95.5% in 2010. So why would we consider going backwards? As the old saying goes, if it isn't broke, don't fix it. We feel that the current law was the fix. And as far as the sincere mistake, the current statute, Minnesota Statute 46.1.12, Subdivision 6, there is a defense for the individual with a sincere mistake that the licensee or individual making the sale relied in good faith upon proof of age. So the penalties would go to the vendor. We feel that education is important, but alone it's not enough. And on behalf of the American Lung Association and thousands of volunteers across the state, we urge you to not support this bill.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Katie Engman. I'm the coordinator of the North Suburban Tobacco Compliance Check Project. I've been the coordinator for the past 8 years. The North Suburban Tobacco Compliance Check Project is a collaboration of 11 Ramsey County cities, and we also collaborate with three other additional cities in Ramsey County to share interests and education and information. As part of this program, I coordinate all the Ramsey tobacco I coordinate all the tobacco compliance checks within participating cities within Ramsey County. I recruit and train student checkers. I work with law enforcement to set up the checks. We provide free vendor training, and I also maintain our records and statistics. Our program is all about making it unlikely that youth will be able to walk into a store and purchase tobacco. We test compliance with the law, not what they know. We go out of our way to help vendors obey the law, but those few who do fail do face consequences on the first, second, and third violations. Over the years, the rate of noncompliance of the law has gone from 40% to 10%. That's over 90% of our vendors pass our tobacco compliance checks. This says our program is working. But it would not work without our cities having the ability or the teeth to impose needed penalties and be able to send the message that selling tobacco is a great responsibility, not something to be taken lightly. A second point I wish to make is that the state has done a very good job in making it easy for vendors to comply with the law. It used to be that clerks had to do the math, and sometimes that was difficult under pressure with lines forming in a store and not always a strong set of the clerks. The Minnesota driver's license now is color-coded for under 21, and it says, I turn 18 on. There's no math involved. I strongly support the continued efforts of our cities to reduce tobacco use to minors and strongly support the existing penalty structure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we'll have Dr. Jordan Backler and Bob Schaefer. Representative Riddle, I have a very long list. This witness? Okay. I apologize, Representative Riddle. We are trying. I would like to take a vote on this. We have several testifiers and about a dozen member questions as well. So if the last witness could come back so Representative Riddle could. And I will, if I don't get through it, I will pull the committee over. Representative Riddle.
Thank you, Chair Peppin. It could have been either or both of you. The question is simply this. So, as I understand it, the intent of this Representative Hollis is that honest or sincere mistakes are addressed, but that people who intentionally are disobeying the law are not being protected by this. To the testifiers, is your implication here that these are not honest mistakes, but that they are intentionally disobeying the law?
Ms. Engman?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I heard it all. I think that the third violation, as Representative Scalzi's pointed out, that the third violation is when state law says the license is to be suspended. You have three strikes in a 24-month period to get out or to have a stronger penalty. I think that honest mistakes happen all the time. I hear the stories of my kids going into the store and saying, they sold to me, they didn't look at the ID, they overrode the scanner, they didn't have their glasses, all the other things that were addressed. But again, it's three strikes. It's the third violation within 24 months. And I will be honest, a lot of communities cannot get out there three times within 24 months to actually even get to that penalty structure. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you. We'll move on to Dr. Jordan Backler. And then Mr. Schaefer, if I could just remind everyone to please keep your comments very brief, that would be helpful.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Again, my name is Dr. Courtney Jordan Beckler, and I'm a preventative cardiologist at the University of Minnesota and School of Public Health, and I'm also a volunteer with the American Heart Association. I'm here today to testify on behalf of the American Heart Association in opposition to House File 962. I can tell you firsthand the devastation that tobacco has on the body, and there's absolutely no good reason to scale back the laws that keep tobacco out of the hands of our kids. tobacco continues to be the number one preventable cause of chronic disease and mortality. I don't know if you guys have ever had the tragic experience of being with someone in the end of their life, but there's nothing worse than having many of my patients say, I wish I never would have started smoking. And then to go on and see them turn the oxygen up as high as I possibly can and have to administer morphine because they feel like they're drowning in their last moments of life. Today in Minnesota, there are 56,000 high school students who smoke. We know that if kids never begin smoking as youth, the chances are low that they will ever pick up the habit once they become adults. Nearly 90% of all adult smokers begin while they're teens or earlier, and two-thirds become regular daily smokers before they reach the age of 19. Overall, roughly a third of kids who become regular smokers before adulthood will eventually die from smoking. In Minnesota, that means over 18,000 of those 56,000 kids who are now smoking will die from smoking. The most important thing we can do as adults, doctors, and legislators is make sure that tobacco products are as difficult as possible for kids to get their hands on. One way to do this is to continue to enforce Minnesota's laws prohibiting youth access to tobacco. I urge you to keep Minnesota's youth access law strong and think about the 18,000 sons, daughters, nieces, nephews, neighbors, and my own children that you know and love who will lose their lives prematurely to tobacco use. I urge you to vote against this bill. Thank you again.
Thank you very much. Mr. Schaefer.
Hi, I'm Bob Schaefer. I'm a city council member in Golden Valley. I do have a letter that the league forgot to hand out from the police chief of the city of Clinton. I'm here just to kind of tell a little story. In Golden Valley, we have a Walgreens store that started to fail multiple compliance checks over a period of, I think it was 17 months. The council was rather concerned. Their license was up for renewal, and we held a public hearing about that renewal. Walgreens came in with their attorney and their regional district manager, talking about their policies, and they have a fairly strict policy of their own corporate policy, prohibiting sales to minors. They have their own training policy, which they train their employees with, and they also do their own compliance checks, unnoticed compliance checks. The council was trying to be understanding as much as possible, and figured at least maybe they made a mistake, maybe the people involved made a mistake. So we gave them a kind of a second chance, really a third chance at this point, and we allowed them to have a 6-month probation period, in which time we would have additional compliance checks specific to Walgreens during that time period. If they passed those, then we would allow them to continue their license for the additional 6 months. During that time period, they did fail compliance checks again. Now, this is a company that knew that we were going to be doing compliance checks. Their employees knew, the management knew that these compliance checks would be going on and that they could potentially lose their license if this happened. And yet, it did happen again. In fact, one of Walgreens' policies is that their employees are supposed to look at their driver's license, which is standard. But then after that, they're also supposed to type in the date of birth. What some of the employees were doing was typing in whatever date of birth came to their mind. In the particular instance of the person who violated it multiple times, the employee, they were typing in their own date of birth over and over again. So at that point, we did not grant them license renewal for the rest of that year. They currently have their license back and are in compliance. I think this shows that the suspension did actually have some teeth and did actually accomplish what it was there for. Now, as a corporation, they have a policy that obviously has some holes in it, with employees can get around it very easily. They try and teach their policy, and they do test for compliance, although they're testing for the compliance themselves. Unfortunately, during the probation period of 6 months, the policy did not work. The concern as a city council person I would have is, how do we actually police their policies? How do we know what they are? How do we know how they're trained? How do we know how many times they're trained?
There's also an underlying fear about how many times children are allowed to buy tobacco in between the compliance checks. So if we have somebody who's deliberately circumventing somebody's rules or policies.
Mr. Schaefer, if you could, it's already been close to 4 minutes, so if you could wrap up, that would be great.
I just like to say that word spreads pretty quickly around kids where they can get tobacco, and I'd rather not have that happen. I don't consider this about what the rules say or what policies, politics say about federal dollars. What it really is really about is protecting children, and I think the law, as it is, it's really simple. We've been following it for years. The statistics show that it works. Don't change it.
Representative Beard, did you have a question for this witness?
A question or just maybe a comment for the committee. I've listened for several testifiers now who talk about how gleefully we pile on companies that have policies and so on, forgetting that we have employees who have individual free wills and can do what they pretty much darn well please. My question of this witness is, here you had a committee, an employee deliberately violating stated public policy, committing fraud, in other words. Did you ever think to write that employee a ticket or prosecute the employee, or did it serve your purposes to pile on the company that had the misfortune of employing the employee?
Mr. Schaefer.
We actually have in our ordinance that the employee was fined each time.
Mm-hmm.
However, it didn't dissuade that person. And the management also said that they would, pay attention to that employee in specific. But I don't think that was really ever done from the results.
Well, Madam Chair, one of the heartburns I had when I was on City Council was we'd get these kind of sting operations that would come up, and the police were very happy to write people up and bring them in front of the council so we could define administrative fines to business owners. But I never saw one single ticket that was written to a kid they caught smoking on the school grounds or standing around downtown on the corner. And we had ordinances against underage smoking, but we didn't write those kind of tickets, nor did we ever actually ticket the employee who sold the tobacco. Just an observation.
If I may, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We'll move on to, we have two people listed from the American Cancer Society. Perhaps those people could come up or at least condense their comments. And then after that, we have Mr. Anderson from the Department of Human Services. Welcome to the committee. If you could just please identify yourself before you begin.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Jessica Knutson, and I'm here to testify in opposition to House File 962 on behalf of the American Cancer Society. The American Cancer Society is strongly opposed to any effort to weaken current laws which prohibit selling tobacco to children. Many of the cigarettes consumed by young people come from illegal sales of underage youth. Over 19% of Minnesota high school students smoke, and that's compared to about 16% of Minnesota adults. You may be surprised to learn that nearly half of teen smokers say that they can buy cigarettes from their local convenience stores and gas stations. We also know that the vast majority of adult smokers started smoking before the age of 18. Smoking is the leading cause of cancer death. If we can reduce youth smoking and prevent cancer and reduce healthcare costs for the next generation, I think that should be a top priority. How do we accomplish this? By effectively enforcing laws against tobacco sales to kids. Minnesota has a good track record in following current youth access laws. Over 90% of Minnesota retailers actually pass the compliance checks. But unfortunately, House File 962 blocks the rigorous enforcement of effective state laws to prevent illegal sales of tobacco to youth. The American Cancer Society strongly urges you to vote no on House File 962 to protect Minnesota kids from tobacco. I'd like to introduce a very special speaker. We have a youth volunteer here from the American Cancer Society, Claire Tedford. Claire?
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Claire Tedford, and I graduated from Southwest High School in Minneapolis last year. I'm here today to tell you why it's important that you vote against House File 962. This is important to me because my parents are doctors and have taught me about the dangers of smoking. People under 18 aren't legally allowed to buy cigarettes, but many of them do. Smokers at my high school would talk about the local marathon station that didn't card. It was 5 blocks from the school. Lots of kids went there and bought cigarettes all the time. Then last year, they must have gotten caught because they didn't sell cigarettes for several months. Now they card everyone. I am really glad that Minneapolis has strict penalties for selling cigarettes to minors. Please oppose House File 962. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you very much. Representative Green, question for the witness.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to request a roll call when it comes to a vote.
Roll call has been requested. There will be a roll call. Next on the list, we have Mr. Anderson. He will be our final witness if he is here. He must not be here. Then we'll move. We'll revert back to questions. Did you want to wrap up before we take questions, Representative Winkler? Representative,
I'll wrap up after the questions, I guess.
Okay, Representative Murray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Howell, will this bill, you think, result in more education for the stores out there, or just the status quo and education of their employees?
Representative Howell.
You know, that would be an opinion. In answering you, I couldn't give you factual information if this will change anything with regard to underage smokers or old people like me. We're not changing current law. Just giving the municipality an option. That's all we're doing.
Okay. Representative Quam?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would not support the original language of must not. I think the may allows flexibility in situations. These in Greater Minnesota, these are the stores where people frequently get their first job. So you've got high school students who are on their first job, and when I was at the U of M as a sophomore or a freshman, I wasn't 20, went to a Lady Gophers basketball game. A high school team came in, I dropped a glove, and one of the students handed it to me and said, here you go, sir, you dropped your glove, and I wasn't 20 and I felt old. When you get some of these young students who, you know, you might look old if you're a college student and not be able to buy, there might be a propensity for making mistakes, you know, rushing, etc. I just think that allowing some flexibility is somewhat reasonable. It doesn't take away any of the penalties, doesn't prevent any of the existing statutes, and doesn't prevent a city council from taking into account that this location, has a training issue. So I just wanted to, put in perspective the employees that work at these locations.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much. And originally it was a question, but I'll just make it faster because I was going to ask Mr. Krugman about the compliance, and we heard the answer from the person from the North Metro Compliance Check Organization. So 90% are in compliance. It's just a small group, 10%. And I just, they're getting second chances. It's repeat violations. I just don't see why we would want to make it another loophole for a very small number of people who are out of compliance. This is a huge public health issue, and I would just encourage the committee strongly to vote no on this. So.
Thank you. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative House, I just want to understand again, we had a little back and forth on what the intention here is of this language. And I want to make sure I understand what your intention is. Is it that you have to meet the minimum state standard, and with three violations there has to be a suspension? But are you giving cities authority that if they want to create a higher standard than the state standard, that included in that higher standard could be an alternative to a suspension? Because to me that does undermine the required suspension after the third violation. So I guess thinking about this language and how you change it moving forward, I want to be very clear what you're hoping to accomplish.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative
Wink,
this municipalities already have the ability to have stiffer penalties and stronger ordinances. This does not take that away from the city whatsoever. The city can completely ignore what I'm doing here today because it's May. But the 10% of the violators are probably the ones that consistently violate. I'm looking more at the 90% that usually always obey the law and accidentally get caught. And I could wrap up right now, Madam Chair, if you'd like me to. I do want to point out one thing about Golden Valley. Obviously, Walgreens was not doing a good job. But I do want to point out that Golden Valley violated the law by giving them 6 months probation. They should have suspended. So there were probably issues with that store between the store and the city, and that gets into different arguments. But people make a choice to smoke. I can't control that. And this, again, does not change anything that a municipality can do. Actually, they can probably be tougher. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing no other questions, Representative McFarlane renews her motion that House File 962 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to HHS policy. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Pepper?
Aye.
Representative Murray?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Representative Beard?
Aye.
Representative Green?
No.
Representative Hancock?
Aye.
Representative Hornstein?
No.
Representative McFarland?
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll?
Aye.
Representative Qualm? Representative Sanders?
Aye.
Representative Scalzi?
No.
Representative Simon?
No.
Representative Erdahl?
Aye.
Representative Winkler?
No.
There being 9 ayes and 6 nays, the motion does prevail and the bill does prevail.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Meeting is adjourned.